The following is a recording of a discussion group at Ordinary Mind Zendo. The texts we take up for study in these groups range from koan collections to poetry to psychoanalytic papers. If you enjoy listening, please consider donating. Ordinary Mind Zendo is a nonprofit organization that depends on the generosity of people like you.
Change in Unity, Huishan's Buffalo. Huishan said to his students, 200 years after I'm dead, a water buffalo will be born in this valley, with the words, I am Huishan on its side. Tell me, would you call it a buffalo or would you call it Huishan?
Usually when I talk about this koan, I mention that it's the only time I got to see Maizumi Roshi in Dokusan. I was presenting this koan to him and doing a really inadequate water buffalo imitation, which had the interesting experience of, imagine sort of crawling around on all fours in front of a totally impassive Japanese man who, does not crack a smile or give any expression at all as you're making a complete idiot of yourself. Yeah? If nothing else, it's a certain lesson in humility. Right?
Did it stay at the level of Minecraft, or was there...
with him and with Bernie, it was nothing but Minecraft at that point, right? There was, there was no discussion of it in terms of anything else. It was simply, can you be a water buffalo for a moment?
Mm-hmm. And so did you pass the koan?
I guess eventually with Bernie I did. Maybe I buffed up a bit, buffalo, a little bit, But,
so. Mm-hmm. Maizumi ran you out?
Yeah, he just ran me out. That's right. It's a lesson in what do you think you're doing with the koan? Are trying to bring about, and to some extent it is just this lesson in wholeheartedness, right? It's you could say the koan is about completely switching self states, so if you're going to do it, you have to do it completely. You can't do it with a little ironic wink and nod. You have to do it, right? Mm-hmm.
That's kind of useless, though, isn't it? Like, in the sense that, like, I've always rolled my eyes at koan practice because, like these people like twist themselves into this psychological knot to get approval from a teacher, but like in their life when they face like a similar type of situation that should elicit the answer to the koan, like you don't know.
Well, I think that was Joko's basic complaint, that these things do not generalize the way you wish they would, right? Mm-hmm. I think that there's something valuable about allowing yourself to just be wrong, experience, the lesson of humility, and to just put yourself into it, and if you make a fool of yourself, what the hell, right? I mean, what's actually at stake? So in that sense, the psychological benefit of getting it wrong is often greater than getting it right, because that's what you're going to encounter in daily life most of the time. Am I willing to put myself into a situation where I might make a fool of myself? Am I willing to do something where I'll just do it without knowing the outcome, right? Or how it'll be judged. And I don't know that that's an enormously spiritual lesson, unless you want to translate it into sort of letting go of ego, self-image. But it has that value. Mm-hmm. I think it can get dressed up in a lot of metaphysical woo-woo, and it's not, you know, it's not worth that. But koans are useful if they give you some practice finding your way out of what looks like an inescapable either or.
Mm-hmm.
Jessica writes about that all the time in terms of the third as the alternative to doer and unto, right? It's of a different perspective. It's how do you get out of either ors, right?
Mm-hmm. My time studying koans is very playful. It's mm-hmm. like you go out on a lark and you, it's almost like you're like dancing with the teacher, you know, just to see sort of like, I'm going to do this step and see what comes back. And yeah. I know there were people who were like, you know, like banging their head against the wall, sometimes literally about moo and stuff like that. But I just never bought into all of that. And teachers that promote that practice, I think, get it wrong.
Well, Mu was the only koan in the sense that made a difference. there you sort of do that until you have a certain kind of big experience.
There's something wrong with you if you don't.
The dilemma is that you're the problem is you don't necessarily see that it's evoking this whole sense of what's wrong with me if I don't, right? A lot of the next level of koans are, as you say, a kind of playfulness that is supposed to be released by Mu, a playfulness of simply merging with all the contents of the koans, right? And the kind of willingness to just, you know, that kind of free flow into the image of it, right?
When you say, that there's something valuable, or part of the experience of a koan might be what sort of doing it without sort of knowing what the outcome is going to be, and that's sort of the opposite picture. For me, at any rate, of what I've heard of the traditional way of talking about koans,
mm-hmm.
is like you're doing this to get this result.
Mm-hmm.
Well, but the result is what Hope says is the sense of playfulness,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's can you allow yourself to be spontaneous?
Mm-hmm.
Koans are. We'd be better off thinking of them as jokes,
mm-hmm.
It's like, did you get the joke or not, right?
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't get the joke, you're going to only get it if you lighten up a little bit and come at it a different direction, right?
So in this case, I think there's a lot of value in, the discursive, approach to koans, which is kind of, taboo. In terms of talking about koans, but I feel a way to approach this is getting fuzzy about the question of would you call it this or that?
Yes, the question is it this or is it that joins your tendency to look for your true nature, right? And the problem is if you think that there are many aspects to who you are, one of which is your ordinary self, the other is your Buddha nature. I mean, water buffalo is like a symbol of enlightenment. It's like the light ox herring pictures. What is your better self? What is the real you? What is, right? All these things. And so If you get, we typically get ourselves stuck in being preoccupied with who's the real me, right? I think a good answer to this kind of thing is, you know, like the old, you know, I'll enjoy Mounds commercial. Right? Sometimes I feel like a nut, sometimes I don't. That's really the same thing as this koan, right? But can you lighten up into that? Sometimes I'm this, sometimes I'm that. Mm-hmm. And my true nature is whichever one I happen to be in the moment, right? Mm-hmm. It's hard when you get so old that you have these references that are 15, 16 years out of date. Nobody knows what you're talking about.
Some of us.
How about inserts a breath mint or inserts a candy mint?
Yeah.
It's two mints in one.
That's right.
This is our lineage.
That's right. So that's a commercial lineage. Yeah.
Duality in commercials. Mm-hmm. Dissertation. Mm-hmm.
You want to read some of the commentary? We'll see.
Yeah.
Many contemporary psychoanalytic theorists, like Philip Romberg, are increasingly becoming comfortable with the view of the self as a multiplicity of discontinuous self-states, a set of discrete, more or less overlapping schemata that, taken together, define who one is, each schema being organized around a particular self, self-other configuration with a distinctive affective flavoring. Mm. This picture of discontinuous self-states does not imply that psychoanalysts are all suddenly becoming mystics. One can understand this model in very ordinary terms. Think of the person you are when you're around your spouse, and then think of who you are around your mother. For most of us, a rather sudden shift in feeling and identity takes place when we switch from one relationship to another. Certainly, I know my teenage son is a very different person around me than he is with his friends. Yet, how different? How much do we remain the same person as we switch roles and self-states? How many of me are there? In a remarkable, though as it turns out fictitious, account of a meeting between Charles Dickens and Fyodor Dostoevsky, biographer Claire Tomlin wrote that Dickens told Dostoevsky, "All the good simple people in his novels, Little Nell, even the holy simpletons like Barnaby Rudge, are what he wanted to have been. And his villains were what he was, or rather what he found in himself, his cruelty, his attacks of causeless enmity towards those who were helpless and looked to him for comfort, his shrinking from those he ought to love. There were two people in him, he told me, one who feels as he ought to feel and one who feels the opposite. From, quote, from the one who feels the opposite, I make my evil characters. From the one who feels as a man ought to, I try to live my life. Only two people, I asked."
So that was Dostoevsky.
Yes. Yes, this was turns out to be entirely fictitious encounter that got put into the official biography.
Of Dostoevsky?
Dickens.
Or Dickens.
Dickens. Got put into Dickens Society journal and put into Tomlin's biography, and she's no slouch. I mean, she this serious biographer, but there was a whole story that came out about this guy who had forged a story and planted it, and sort of had done. He has a whole background in it.
This guy, actually speaking of different self states, he was like an academic. In England, who had he would write under different personas,
yes,
and different
right.
names, and some of them would critique other ones.
Yes, you know, he would, right. One, he would have one review the other, and write letters to the editor about the first one. He was a nut, yeah. He wrote under all these different names.
No, sometimes he felt like a nut.
Yeah.
Sometimes he was a nut.
Yeah.
The situations you described, though, make me think that, like, it's not an issue that we ask which is the real me. We generally say that's not the real me. Like, the me with my mother, you know, oh, that's just this aberration that she brings out. Is,
right.
I feel like how most people...
Well, or most or people might harbor a fear that that's the real me,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
That you, part of what bothers you about it is a sense of it brings out the latent self-doubt or insecurity that's really who I am, and I'm faking it all the other times,
mm-hmm.
right? So you can have this very sort of conflicted sense of what does it mean that I act or feel this way around in this situation, right?
In both cases, like, you're privileging one as being more real.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. In either case, yeah, there are lots of different ways you can tell the story, but it often is trying to make one of them the real you rather than say, well, I'm like this and then I'm like that, right? And that who I am is very context dependent, right? Or we might imagine that being context independent is the highest goal.
Mm-hmm. Is that possible?
Yes, is such a thing possible, right? Sometimes the most context independent people are the sort of most rigid and compulsive, of course, you know, or
mm-hmm.
they're completely impervious to anything, right?
Mm-hmm. Would an autistic person fall then?
Yeah, I mean, that's one kind of, you know, version of that. You could say somebody who is not responsive to relational changes.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Somebody else? Oh,
yeah, I'll read. In this fable, Dickens is able to accept the fact that he contains opposites. Dostoevsky can go further, and like Walt Whitman says, I contain multitudes. Being able to hold separate different aspects of ourselves, being able to tolerate the differences and even the conflicts that arise because who we are in different contexts and with different people is an example of ordinary or healthy dissociation. Our ordinary and basically healthy way of experiencing the shifts we undergo as we shift roles and states is to experience and tolerate a certain degree of awkwardness and conflict. We can recognize how we suddenly revert to an old childish way of being when we go home for the holidays, one at odds with our usual mature way of being around friends and colleagues. There might be a sheepish acknowledgement that we are falling into old patterns or that our mothers can still push our buttons, but most of the time we can tolerate holding the two versions of ourselves in mind at once and feel the conflict. In the words of Philip Bromberg, self-states are what the mind comprises. Dissociation is what the mind does. The relationship between self-states and dissociation is what the mind is. It's the stability of that relationship that enables a person to experience continuity as I, a flexible relationship among self-states through the use of ordinary dissociation is what allows a human being to engage the ever-shifting requirements of life's complexities with creativity and spontaneity.
That was a pretty good introduction to Bromberg.
Yeah.
I was just thinking
that. Hope a few Zen teachers read it.
Where is this edition from? It was from the... This is different from the book.
It's a little different.
It doesn't say that the Dickens-Dostoevsky thing is fictitious. This is apparently an earlier version.
Oh, the printout you have?
Yeah.
You say? Oh, I see.
No, they're just some words and phrases.
Well, but the whole thing about that encounter being fictitious is not in here. Speaking of two different realities.
That's the limited edition.
It was written by Barry's other son.
Was there a later second printing where they corrected it? I don't remember.
That's
where did you get that?
I think that's from Wisdom. I think it's
What did she have?
This is what was this is the link that you provided in the
It's a little different.
It's different.
Yeah.
Oh. Go figure. Maybe it got corrected and they keep.
I think it was the Galleys.
It seems like a
Galleys. There was a pre-published version,
mm-hmm.
PDF.
Yeah.
Now, is there, you say the, would you say that each self-state like has some effect on the other ones, or are there sort of like just a bunch of stuff that's kind of arbitrarily kind of tied together with some other psychic process?
Well, that's sort of Bromberg's issue, sort of how much do we allow one to coexist with another, how much do they become at war with each other. Bromberg zeroes particularly in on shame, you know, as sort of a barrier between the self states, where to the point of one becoming sometimes unconscious of the other because of a shame barrier. He thinks the normal version of dissociation, like that we're describing here, is where you can feel a degree of conflict or awkwardness, right? How do they affect themselves? Well, I mean, it's like if I know in some circumstances I will behave foolishly, it may be in another circumstance I'll have a little more humility. Right, I might have a sense that less a sense. Well, this is me, and I always know how. I'm always in control, and I always say the right thing, and nobody can ever, get over on me. Right. Well, I know, that's not true. I can allow myself to know it's not true, and maybe I don't hold myself up so arrogantly as a result. Right.
There's a funny relationship between them in terms of, like, I'm thinking of like the Christian. I hate to say Republicans, but like all these people who have these scandals. And
I hate to say that word.
It's like an oxymoron. But like they present themselves as these like very moral. And I feel like the more loudly they yell about that stuff, the bigger the scandal that comes out usually.
Yeah, this is really severe dissociation where one part can't admit the existence of the other.
But it seems like the other part gets louder because of the existence of the other.
I think that the more you're trying to suppress something, that's one part of the self at war with another, and it has to constantly insist on its own exclusiveness and rightness.
I guess I think that I find this discussion, not our discussion, but the discussion here, frustrating because it just seems so astonishingly focused on a self that's isolated from the universe. Like that there's just not sufficient attention to people socialization, people being enculturated, people's self being constructed based on the particular worlds in which they live, people being, it presumes some. The discussion seems to me to presume some notion of a kind of an isolated self that could be at war with itself without any serious discussion of how that self is formed in a particular world at a particular time.
Well, I think actually the examples I gave of different self states were ones in different relationships.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's exactly what I think, you know, gives rise to different self states or different relational configurations. I say how you're different with your mother than your spouse, mm-hmm. how you are with colleagues or versus friends. I think, you know, you can think of these as trivial, you know, relationships compared to other, you know, forms of social conditioning, but the frame I'm trying to put it in is that self-states are differential relational configurations.
But it's at a pretty micro level. I mean, it's not saying, I mean, Chris's example, for example, has to do with what does it mean to be a self from a particular part of the country at a particular time, struggling with issues of one's past and the politics of the time. I mean, it really becomes wildly
more
layered.
Psychological than sociological in, mm-hmm. in that sense. Mm-hmm. That's right.
And is it fair to say, like, that part of what you're saying is that this dissociation or like this self-hate that can lead to severe dissociation can happen regardless of sociological factors?
Yes, it's right. So
it's just a different, like, a different picture than the picture you're describing.
Or different motivations for the dissociation, mm-hmm. maybe.
I mean, I guess the argument could be at different moments in time, it manifests itself in different kinds of ways, depending on the configuration of the culture, the society, the historical context, the gender relations that are taken for granted. I mean,
yeah,
all of those things.
You know, I think, Bromberg's perspective would be that these modes are primarily set up in early childhood around family and sibling configurations, and that these ramify through more complex social interactions and the embeddedness of a bigger social sphere, but the prototypes are in the family.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
Yeah.
That early, it's the early experience of acceptance versus shame, of security versus danger, you know, of attachment versus disconnection that sets up a sense of what part of me is acceptable to this person, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you're saying,
what can I be proud of? What do I have to hide?
So are you saying, so there's no culture outside of these relationships? Like, there's no culture outside of your relationship to your mother? In the sense that that is the culture that you're in?
Well, early on, it's, you know, who you... how you're mothered is going to be determined by the culture your mother's in, right?
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, the idea is that this is your world and these are the prototypes and it expands from there. But obviously, what a family is culturally determined, right? What's
mm-hmm.
the role of the mother and what's the role of the father, right? How often are they around? What do they do? How much do they... You know, what are the expectations put on a little girl or a little boy? Right?
Mm-hmm.
All that's social, but you first encounter it in the family. Right, should we move on? Gail, you want to read them?
Yes. Our lives are about change, about how we change as the world around us changes, but also about how we experience a sense of continuity through changing circumstances. When I change, am I still the same person? Is there some core sense of myself that continues to exist no matter what happens to me? Taking a cue from Wei Shan, if I turned into a buffalo, would I still be me? What could it possibly mean to still be Kui Shan in the body of a water buffalo?
And this is also related to what we were talking about in the Galen Strawson book, where he writes against narrativity. Right? He has this strong personal sense of discontinuity between past and present selves. Right? And,
mm.
So it's how much of that do you take for granted as a normal or natural state of affairs? How much variation is there in what people experience as continuity? Right? Mm-hmm. Is there something wrong with you if you don't? Right?
Mm-hmm.
Or especially right? Is it especially enlightened if you don't? You know, Krishnamurti, I remember, always used to, you know, if he talked about his childhood, he referred to that boy.
Mm-hmm.
Was this he also never used the personal pronoun. He never said I. You know, he always said, he referred to the speaker.
Insufferable.
Which was close to insufferable, someplace between enlightened and insufferable, right? It's like, such a fine line, you know?
You're telling us.
Oh, God.
So it seems like continuity, though, is like accepting the karma that came along with the self-state before this one.
Yes, I think that's a big part of it, and I think that...
could you say what that means?
Wait,
Chris, can you
say
that? What is
that?
Say
that again?
That's how you see that you are you because of the things that have shaped you, the things that have happened to you. You didn't just spring fully formed out of the moment, but that you were the person you are because of your history.
But the continuity is like accepting that as the board for the game, like
yeah.
Everything that
mm-hmm.
came before.
Yeah,
everything that you did.
Everything you did and that was done to you. Oh, it's supposed to be a little less system. Yeah.
I guess the difficulty of this has
all
to
all right,
do
that's
with
fine. I'll come back and do that. But I'm in the middle of
with whether continuity is a good.
Right now, so mm-hmm. I can't talk.
Like,
I'll,
is it a good?
I'll meet
is
you
it inherently a good?
We'll do whatever you want,
yeah.
Right?
I think that
okay.
that. I guess that's one of the things. If continuity is defined as some kind of ideal. Under all circumstances, I can find this continuity. I can see the relationship between what came before and where I am now. How does one come to see that the continuity itself can be pathological?
In what sense?
The self that I wish myself to be and that is part of the self that I am is based on really distorted understandings of myself and of the world in which I'm a part.
Yeah, well, I mean, that I think that is a kind of honesty about your history and honesty about the things that shaped your opinions and pictures of yourself, right? That... you see that because I was brought up in a certain way, I always came to see myself as such and such, right?
Mm-hmm.
As special or inferior, or as stupid or whatever it is, right? So that there's ways in which I have a long narrative history that in many ways could be false or arbitrary because of the particular circumstances I grew up in. Right?
Well, one example of this would be, you know, like Israel and Palestine, right?
Yeah.
Like if you're the youngest generation of a given culture, do you take as part of your narrative some endless story of being at war with the people north and south of you?
That's right. It's how much do I automatically identify with a particular way a story has been told.
Can you inherit the narrativity of, like, you know, like your enemy's culture? Or?
Yeah,
right. Actually, I was asking.
Well, you know, it's what, look, I think, people are always attempting to find some place to stand outside the narrative they inherited, and it's what critique is in some sense, or
mm-hmm.
any kind of critical thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And you can do it to a certain point, right? I mean, somebody like Nietzsche tries to do it at a very radical level. People do it to different degrees of how much can you stand out of your culture, right? I mean, I think that's always a question of degree. You could say that the very desire to stand outside of your culture is shaped by a particular cultural moment, right? So.
I mean, also, like, on the individual level, it's like, if you're in one self state, you have that narrative that is a continuity all the way back to your childhood. Like,
right.
I'm an asshole, I'll always be an asshole. And when you're in another self state, you have a different narrative continuity.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, sometimes they overlap, and sometimes, like, you know, if I'm in a bad way, I just am only identifying with all the bad shit.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not like,
mm-hmm.
I can't step out of that, mm-hmm. right? And vice versa.
Yeah, so it's part of what that practice we try to do is create some fluidity between states so you don't get stuck in them the same way, that you experience conflict. And, you know, in Bromberg's terms, the goal is if you... are in one of those that you feel the conflict with another one, that the other ones don't totally disappear, right? That you can be of two minds about yourself,
mm-hmm.
right? Which is a big improvement over being just in the asshole mind, right?
That's interesting because both self-states have access to the same historical knowledge in a way.
Yeah.
But they're very... bad biographers
picking and choosing.
So bad.
Right, they tell very different narratives, right?
Mm-hmm.
Different stories.
Mm-hmm.
Need a little, some maybe a little more?
Yeah, sure.
Somebody who hasn't read it, anyone? Gonna
volunteer. Where are we starting?
Where'd you start?
Yeah, no, where'd we start?
Start?
The part we're gonna start with Kweishan invites us to.
Kweishan invites us to move freely with creativity and spontaneity in response to his question. How shall we understand these different states of Kweishan and buffalo? How do we express both continuity and change? The dramatic shift from Kweishan to buffalo illustrates the feeling of almost total otherness that can accompany the shift of one self-state in relation to another, even in what is fundamentally healthy dissociation. Each self-state feels like a complete identity in its own right, and yet our mind is made of a wide variety of such states, some of which seem to bear very little resemblance to the others. Kweishan uses the metaphor of reincarnation to illustrate how profound the gap
right.
between states can feel. Shohaku Okamura, in his masterful book, Living by Vow, has remarked that while he doesn't believe that we transmigrate from one life to another, he's certain we all transmigrate within this life.
It's
which
nice
is
to see him say that. Somebody, you know, from a traditional Soto background,
mm-hmm.
you know, not fussing about reincarnation, but using it metaphorically
mm-hmm.
for what's going on, you know, psychologically.
Mm-hmm.
What should I keep going?
Yeah, you could read it a little more.
Which is a nice way of describing our shift from one self-state to another. Yet the shift isn't total. The buffalo is still called Kweishan, and all my self-states answer to the name Barry. We are not here in Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde territory, where one part of the self is totally alien and unknown to the others. If we think of the buffalo as being the animal from the famous ox herding pictures, we can imagine that the buffalo represents Buddha nature that takes on different guises, sometimes called Kweishan, sometimes called buffalo, according to circumstances. That way of approaching the buffalo leads us toward the assumption that there is some sort of continuous underlying essence, whether we call it Buddha nature or the soul, that transmigrates and appears in different forms. There is a saying, wherever you go, there you are. We intuitively feel the truth of that statement. There's something of ourselves, our perspective, our experience that we bring to each new situation. No matter how different the experience, we want to say it's still my experience. One side of the experience of being in psychoanalysis or practicing meditation is to see how much we unconsciously configure our subjective experience of a new situation along old lines. Mm-hmm. One aspect of what analysts call transference is the way we experience the people in our present lives in some way as replays of old scenarios we enacted with our parents and siblings. We come to new relationships primed with old hopes and fears, all the things we've learned over the years to expect in the way of satisfaction or disappointment from others.
Can I ask a question about, if you don't mind, going back to just the previous paragraph? The last sentence in the previous paragraph, that way of approaching the buffalo leads us to assumption that there's some sort of continuous underlying essence, what we call Buddha nature of the soul, that transmigrates to buffalo. Could you talk about what that means? Is that at an individual level? Is that at some kind of essential human level? What does that really refer to?
Well, I think it refers to a metaphysical fantasy that doesn't exist, but is a kind of recurrent byproduct of a way of talking that makes it seem as if there must be a stuff that is flows, you know, is poured into different bottles or. You know, the dough before the cookie cutter is applied, right? Buddhism really would like to say that there is no such underlying stuff, there's no underlying essence. But Christian form, you have much more of a sense of a soul being an essence inside a body, and something like Hegel, you have Geist being a historical force that takes different shapes in different circumstances. It's a very tempting form of language that sometimes is used intentionally and sometimes slips in inadvertently, right? It's the kind of thing that drove Wittgenstein nuts. that tendency of language to create hidden essences. Enough of an answer for now?
I guess it's connected for me to this discussion of what continuity means. I mean, you could say that at the self level, or even at the community or society level, there is a tremendous desire to hold on to some notion that there is some, back to a discussion we had a few weeks ago, authentic something that is part of the continuity. Right, there's an essential state, state, not just individual state, but state.
Well, again, there's a what continues socially are persons, and persons are you know, bodies with names attached to them. The bodies keep changing, but the name doesn't change. What does it mean to keep using the same name even as you go from being 3 years old to being 90 years old, and from, you know, being, you know, going through all these different roles and responsibilities. But the whole social process of naming means that you create a kind of continuity through the lots of different stages and phases, right? Although you then have demarcations where that, you know, at a certain age, you suddenly are a kind of person who could be drafted or can buy a drink or can vote or can take out a mortgage. You're maybe the same person you were when you were 5 years old, but that different ages are associated with different roles and then different selves. You're a different person if you're a school child or a voter or a soldier.
The motive, so like, I don't think it's language so much as like the desire to not die, mm-hmm. right? It's this desire to not change or be changed
that's
by
right.
circumstance that we I want this
right.
continuity in like a soul, basically.
Well, we make up the
right.
idea of a soul in
yeah.
order to imagine we won't die. I think that's probably true. Mm-hmm.
I think day to day too, though.
But, you know, Krishnamurti calls it the child, that boy, because precisely because he doesn't want to identify with a previous self, right? And a lot of what Brahma calls dissociation is a kind of shame-driven desire not to be identified with a different or past aspect of yourself.
Mm-hmm.
I guess.
But yes, there's a part of us. I mean, this is what dissociation is. Part of us has a strong longing for continuity, if not immortality.
Mm-hmm.
Another part of us says, I don't want to be remembered as that skinny, gawky teenager, right? I want to feel split off from that other embarrassing side, right? That's not me. I'm not like that anymore. Right?
Mm-hmm.
So we're pulled in both directions, right? We hold in some kind of tension those different wishes.
What about the wish to be somebody completely new, different?
Well, yes. I mean, people get divorced, take a different job, move to a different city, move to a different country, right?
Mm-hmm. But you're still you.
Well, yes and no, right? I mean, sometimes you want to really leave the old you behind. People sometimes go to the extreme of changing their names.
Dharma names.
You get a Dharma name, that's right. It's
mm-hmm.
a good way to do it. Disappear into a monastery, get a whole new Dharma name, right?
Mm-hmm.
Leave all that other messy stuff behind. Right?
A better or different version of this call on, like, I'll put a label, you know, I'll call you.
Yeah, that's right. Are you really Charlotte or are you Joko, right?
Mm-hmm.
The title of the chapter is Change in Unity.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember the word unity being used in the chapter, so I was trying to make connections. Is that the fluidity between the self states? The tension you just talked about?
Well, the unity is bringing all these different self states and having them answer to the same name, right? Or whether you think that there's continuity of self over time or over self states, right? We want to have a certain degree of unity, or you're in Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde
mm-hmm.
territory, right? Or psychopath territory, where you have no sense of responsibility for what you've done in another circumstance, right? So there's all this tension between tolerating change and discontinuity and accepting a certain responsibility for unity, right? We have to sort of pull off doing both of those things. I even remember a Tricycle article one time that asked, can a Buddhist take out a mortgage? As if you don't believe in a continuous self, who's promising to pay this back?
What is your signature name in the contract?
Well, that's a good question.
So that's all, you know. It's taking it to somewhat ridiculous, you know, conclusions of this notion of discontinuity, right? It means that Buddhists don't have selves, but they're persons, right? They're still going to be called by the same name.
That would apply to any contract, right. Marriage.
Right.
See, Barry, I'm stuck on this thing about the kind of macro world. One of the patterns could be racism. This has an astonishingly powerful hold on a particular country, our country. So that's a pattern. It's continuity. That is continuity. That level of hate and hierarchy is part of the continuity. People are desperate to hold on to it. Desperate, and it shows how unbelievably hard it is for people to change when our notion of continuity is tied to a certain, you know, in this case, ideological, historical, constructed thing that is seen as natural. So there's where the continuity, when continuity becomes desperate pathology.
You just said continuity is a byproduct of invariant power relations within a society, right? Mm-hmm. And that those power relations are translated into racial or class prejudices, right? And that you're not going to eradicate a certain way of thinking without eradicating a certain class structure, is one way to think about it, right? It's the dilemma of a philosophy that says everything changes except, what's most neurotic, what's most structurally unfair. Everything else, right?
Continuity isn't destiny, though. I mean, like, people benefit from racism, so they recreate it every day.
That's right.
Yeah, the class, the power system is intact, and people benefit from it, and they have no desire to disrupt their own privilege, right? And they typically will justify the privilege by calling it, in some sense, natural. Right? Even somebody as basically wise and good as Aristotle ended up with the notion of natural slaves, in part because culturally nobody had a clue how to run a complex economy without slave labor. Nobody could figure it out, is what it came down to. They didn't, it was intractable as poverty in capitalism, right? It's just like poverty seems to be an irreducible aspect of capitalism. Everybody would like there to be an alternative. Nobody's ever sort of come up with it, right? And I think slavery represented that in the classical world, but even lots of good people who thought it was a bad institution or a bad idea had no way to picture a society running otherwise. So you get stuck in certain economic and power scenarios that start to seem natural because there are no other examples around. Nobody can figure it out.
I feel like the slaves might have had a few ideas.
Well, as I said, the dream of every slave wasn't freedom, but to have a slave of his own.
So maybe not.
You just want to switch sides. In part, one of the explanations of the end of slavery in the classical world was the fall of the Roman Empire, that suddenly this whole social structure collapsed and people had to do their own goddamn labor. They couldn't, you know, the whole structure that of powerful landowning owners and slaves fell apart, and it was sort of much more every man for himself for a while. Right? So people had to get used to doing the work that slaves used to do because the system wasn't there anymore. All right, it's about that time. I'm going to catch up with Sam. Thank you all.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.